Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to our super fantastic fun Friday show here on Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and as promised, our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And another thing about Jimmy that is relevant today is that he knows a whole lot about St. Paul and the letters of St. Paul and the travels and companions of St. Paul. And today is the feast day of Timothy and Titus. We celebrate St. Paul earlier in the week, so we'll focus on St. Paul today. Jimmy, thanks for coming in and doing that with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So St. Paul wrote more books of the Bible than anybody else. Is that correct, or am I exaggerating? More books. Let's start with the New Testament, I suppose.
Okay. Well, yeah. We'll go with that.
We'll go. Okay, thanks for going with that.
There's a bit of a question, though, because like Luke doesn't always sign his stuff. In fact, Luke never signs his stuff.
Okay.
And there is a question of was Luke the amanuensis for some of the letters of St. Paul?
Oh.
Because in the ancient world, you normally didn't write your own letters. Even if you were literate, you normally didn't write them yourself. You would dictate them to a scribe who was a trained professional writer, and then the scribe would go off and make a copy that was more polished and bring it back to you. In fact, usually make two copies, one for you to keep and one for you to send.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke may have done that for some of the letters of Paul because scholars have noted that there are shifts in the style of the different Pauline letters, which may indicate he's using a different scribe at that point. And we know Luke was a longtime traveling companion who was also literate because he wrote Luke and Acts. Also, some people have suggested that Luke may be the author of Hebrews because that one is not signed, and that's one of Luke's characteristics. Some people have said it has a style similar to Luke's.
I see.
And so Luke may have written
or been involved in writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Luke is one among the companions of St. Paul.
Yeah.
We mentioned Timothy and Titus. Who are Timothy and Titus?
So, well, they're just these guys, you know.
Are you going to make me work hard today?
Well, yeah.
No, they're just these guys. Okay.
So Titus is the first of the companions to start traveling with Paul.
Okay.
And of the two,
yeah.
He had other companions before Titus, even it seems. But Titus was a Gentile. We know that for a fact because Paul says that he was a Greek, which could mean specifically he was a Hellenist in terms of his language and culture, but it could just mean he's a Gentile in general.
I see.
So Paul mentions that in Galatians, and he mentions that he took Titus with him to Jerusalem when there was a controversy about circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's either a reference to a visit that occurred in Acts 11 or more probably, and I would say basically certainly, in Acts 15. So we know that Titus was traveling with Paul by Acts 15, but Paul doesn't start traveling with Timothy until Acts 16. So Titus was the first companion of the two, and at that time, Paul's home base was Antioch, and there were a significant number of Gentiles in Antioch, Gentile Christians. And so Paul at one point refers to Titus as his son, which tends to mean he was one of his converts. So in all likelihood, Titus was a Greek speaker from Antioch or at least living in Antioch who Paul converted to Christianity. And then he traveled around with him, went to the Jerusalem Council, and continued to minister alongside St. Paul for a number of years into the 60s. Because he, towards the end of Paul's career, is given a missionary charge to serve as Paul's legate or deputy on mm-hmm. the island of Crete. to appoint priests and so forth there. So he worked with him for a period of decades. Timothy is the better known of the companions, and he was a native of Lycaonia, which is in Turkey. It's the same sort of region where the Galatian epistles are written to.
Okay.
And Timothy had a mixed parentage. His mother was a woman named Eunice, or Eunike in Greek, who was Jewish and had herself been born into a Jewish family. Her mother was named Lois. We happen to know that. But Timothy's father was Greek. And so he had this kind of mixed upbringing, partly Jewish, partly Greek. His father apparently allowed Eunice to teach him the Jewish scriptures and to have him taught the scriptures by others. So Paul at one point mentions how Timothy has known the scriptures since his youth, but Luke informs us that he also wasn't circumcised. So apparently Timothy's father drew the line at circumcision, so to speak, and didn't let him be circumcised. And so it's amazing when you're reading Acts, because we've just had the Acts 15 council,
right,
where everybody has gone to Jerusalem and concluded, okay, Gentiles don't need to be circumcised to become Christians and stuff.
Yes.
And this is like Paul's big vindication.
Right. He wins, you know? Kind of.
Yeah, he totally does. And so it's like he gets this letter saying, hey, guess what, guys? You don't got to be circumcised. This is Paul's moment of triumph. And in the next chapter, he circumcises Timothy personally. And it's
Timothy's
like –
Timothy's got to be like, wait,
what is up with that? And so the reason that Luke says that Paul circumcises Timothy is because all of the Jews in the area where they were going to be ministering knew that Timothy's father was a Greek. And so they knew that he wasn't circumcised and he wouldn't be able to fully minister to Jews to help them embrace the Christian faith.
Right.
And so Paul circumcised him. So you could say, nope, he's a full Jew. He's been circumcised,
right,
and he's here to tell you about Jesus.
Well, actually, so we can kind of tease about that because, you know, Timothy, hey, thanks, Paul. But
but it shows – I mean, that's a major thing to get circumcised as an adult.
Yeah. But
in a world with no anesthetics.
I mean, at least a glass of wine.
No painkillers.
Yeah, right. No ibuprofen. But the thing is, it does show the commitment of both Paul and Timothy to do what was necessary to communicate the gospel to people where they were.
Right.
Like, it's like, oh, if that's what you need, you know, if you need me to be a vegetarian, I'll be a vegetarian. If you need me to be like whatever. But the important thing is
And he Christ. Says he says that in he talks about that in the Corinthian epistles. I become all things to all men.
Yeah. And Timothy followed him in that. Okay. So before we have to go to a break, and people are already calling with their questions for you, and I didn't even give out the phone number.
Ooh.
So people want to talk about.
They've been listening.
Paul
on prior
his,
shows.
Yeah, and his companions. But I am unclear on something.
Okay.
There are the apostles, and then there are the successors to the apostles. The successors to the apostles we call bishops.
Right.
They carry on many of the functions of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
Were Timothy and Titus bishops?
The term bishop, so in Greek it's episkopos, and it just means overseer.
Yeah.
Epi means over or upon, and skopos, you know, like the English word scope,
to see. Right.
So an episkopos is an overseer, and that term was used somewhat flexibly in the first century. Originally, the terms for different offices in the church were kind of fluid. You had presbyteros or presbyter, which just means elder.
Yeah.
And you had episkopos, which means overseer. And then you had diakonos, which means servant or minister.
Yeah.
And these terms were kind of flexible, and it took a while for them to get sorted out. So Paul, even though he's clearly an apostle and is, in fact, emphatic on that point, he at one point describes himself as a diakonos. As a servant or minister.
Right.
And you have Peter at one point, who's also clearly an apostle, describing himself as a fellow elder. And so you have a lot of fluidity in these terms. And it seems that it took a while for them to gravitate to the kind of three offices that we see. So the lowest sounding term of the three, which one sounds lowest?
Deacon.
Deacon, right, yeah. Minister. So that got attached to the lowest office, what we now call a deacon.
Yeah.
Which of the other two terms, elder and overseer, sounds the most highfalutin?
Definitely overseer.
Overseer. So
yeah.
That got attached to the highest office, what we would now call a bishop.
Right.
And that left presbyteros, or presbyter, priests, for
yeah.
priests,
yeah.
The middle office. And that transition was underway in Paul's day, but it really wasn't – the terms hadn't become fixed by the end of his life. So you had in his if you read the pastoral epistles that Paul wrote, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus,
yeah.
In the pastoral epistles, it's clear that presbyter and bishop are still fluid. Because Paul's using those two terms for the same office, mm-hmm. where he's basically talking about priests. But by – and so that's in the AD 60s when
okay.
he wrote those. But 50 years later, when Ignatius of Antioch was writing, it's clear those terms have become fixed. So that
yeah.
Ignatius says, unless a church has a bishop, priests, and deacons, it's not even a church.
Yeah.
So they've become fixed by that point. And because Timothy and Titus live in that transitional period, it's a little tricky to assign their exact role. Clearly, like bishops, they have charge of more than one congregation, because that's
okay.
what Paul's telling them to take care of in 1 Timothy and in Titus. He's left them in Ephesus and on Crete to appoint priests in different congregations. And so they clearly have authority over more than one congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But because the term bishop was fluid at this point, they wouldn't have necessarily been called bishops, even
yeah.
though they were overseeing multiple congregations. But by the time the terms became fixed – in the second century, or by the second century, it's natural for second century and later authors to look back on them and describe them as bishops.
Because so, they were doing what was familiar to the bishop role.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have later Christian authors saying things like Timothy was bishop of Ephesus
yeah.
and Titus was the first bishop of Crete.
Yeah.
And
well,
so
nowadays the bishop places his hands on men to make them priests. Bishops mm-hmm. place their hands on priests to make them bishops. Would that have happened with Timothy and Titus?
Yeah, Paul? In fact, yes. We know that the laying on of hands was used to commission people to perform ministry in the church. That happened with Paul himself. In Acts 13, at Antioch, the elders of the church are praying and fasting, and the Holy Spirit says, set aside Barnabas and Paul for the work to which I've called them. So they fast and they lay hands on them, and then they send them off on what's now known as the first missionary journey.
Yep.
And then in 1 Timothy, Paul talks to Timothy – or actually in 1 and 2 Timothy, I'd have to look to check which – but Paul refers to an event where he and some elders laid their hands on Timothy to empower him. Now, it's not clear in that case, is this ordination, empowerment to go minister, or is it confirmation, or is it something else?
Yeah.
Because laying on of hands got used for a lot of things. But at some point – and especially given the fact Paul himself had hands laid on him to go perform ministry, the same thing would have happened for Timothy.
888-318-7884 is our number. We're talking with Jimmy Akin about St. Paul and his many companions, most particularly Timothy and Titus today, because it's their day. We'll be right back with more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a couple of very special offers for all of you interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and my DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a saving of over 70%. I wrote this book and I made this DVD specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or my DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. And at $3 a copy when purchased in bulk, it's perfect for parish distribution and any of your adult faith formation needs. And in an effort to get copies into as many hands as possible, this weekend we're offering free media mail shipping within the continental United States. There's simply no better time to place your order. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about Paul and his companions as we enjoy this Friday afternoon with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. It being the Feast of Timothy and Titus, I think the obvious question, Jimmy, is if you and I were Timothy and Titus, which one would be Timothy and which one would be Titus?
That's a little personal, isn't it?
Well, really? Now, why? Because of the circumcision thing? Is that what you're thinking?
Dude, the pure, all things are pure.
I wasn't thinking that. I don't know.
It depends on which criterion you would want to use.
I think I would be Titus and you would be Timothy. Timothy being the more famous, well-known, and well-regarded.
I'm heard by 10,000s of people every day saying that, yeah.
Really? You think 10,000s, huh?
Oh, yeah. Our audience is definitely in the 10,000s.
Tens of thousands. But
whatever.
I know Jimmy Akin, sir, and I am no Jimmy Akin. 888-318-78. You don't know what to do with that, do you?
Well, 888-318-7884. I was just going to say, okay, so 80s presidential election flashback.
Can you spell potato?
Thank you, Dan Quayle. Yes, I can.
Well, I'm surprised at how many people have questions about Timothy and Titus. You feel open to taking questions?
Sure, absolutely. Of course.
All right.
That's what I'm here for.
Rex.
I'm taking yours, aren't I?
Yeah, barely. You're Rex in Dallas, Texas, listening on 910 AM Guadalupe Radio. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hello, Jimmy.
Howdy.
Hey, listen, I want to preface my statement by this. You can judge any man's preaching and teaching by this rule. Is he Pauline? Does his doctrine start and finish according to the statements made of Christian doctrine made by the Apostle Paul? No matter how wonderful a man may seem in his gifts and apparent consecration, the gospel is not Pauline. It is not the gospel. Paul calls down the anathema, that is the curse of God himself, upon anyone that preaches any other gospel than what he declared, Galatians 1.
Rex, I want to get to your question, but first I want to say that I don't really agree with your opening statement. You said that, now it's true, if you're preaching a gospel different than the one that Paul preached, well, then it's a false gospel. Sure, absolutely. But what you said was that someone needs to both start and finish with Paul's statements. And that's, I would say that's not true, because Jesus himself came before Paul, and the gospel's ultimately rooted in what Jesus said and taught and did. And so Jesus, and I think Paul would agree here, Jesus takes priority over Paul. And so really, for preaching the gospel, you need to start with what Jesus said, not simply what's in the Pauline epistles, but the gospels that form background to them. And then one also shouldn't restrict it to just the Gospels in Paul, because the Holy Spirit chose to inspire other books of the New Testament, like Peter and Jude and James and Revelation and all those books too. So I would say we need to take a comprehensive approach to the Gospel and all of its different dimensions as found throughout Scripture.
Well, the Bible is for us, not all to us. If you read Matthew, Jesus said, I am not come under the law sheep of the house of Israel to this Gentile woman in chapter 15 and 10. He told the 12 not to go to Gentiles, only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Mm-hmm. Said he came to his own, and his own received them not.
Right. So it's clear that he had a special mission that he was performing for certain people, namely the Jews, but in his own day. But he also indicated that after he's finished his mission, he's going to send his followers among the other sheep of his flock, namely the Gentiles, so that there can be one flock and one shepherd. And so that was a question of not who is this message for, but when is it going to be delivered to those people? In any event, though, Rex, I understand you have a question about Timothy and Titus. So what's that? How can I help you there?
No, I guess the screener got that mixed up. But anyway, Peter and the 12 were not on the same team as Paul and his crew. Peter and the 12 went to the Jews, and their gospel was a gospel of works and faith.
Ooh.
Paul's gospel is faith alone by grace alone.
Yeah. So, Rex, I think you need to maybe read the book of Galatians, because you're drawing on some themes that come from Galatians, but it says, Paul does in that passage say that Peter had been entrusted with a mission to the Jews, just like he, Paul, had been entrusted with a mission to the Gentiles. So that's where that comes from. But he also says other things in Galatians. And even if you read that statement carefully, he says that Peter was entrusted with this mission. By whom? By God. So really, just like who was it that entrusted Paul with the mission to the Gentiles? Again, it was God. And so they are all on the same team. They're all working to preach the gospel. They're just preaching it to different groups. And actually, it's not a gospel of works. One of the things that Paul indicates, if you read the first part of Galatians 2, is that that the Jerusalem apostles agreed with him that you don't need to be circumcised. That's the preeminent work of the law that makes you a Jew. And so he says, no, they agreed that Gentiles don't need to be circumcised. They were preaching the same gospel, and they didn't even compel Titus to bring him into the picture. They didn't compel Titus to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. So the Jerusalem apostles agreed with Paul on all this, and that's why a little bit later in Galatians 2, when Paul rebukes Peter at Antioch, he says, you and I know that man is justified by God and not by works of the law. So he cites the fact Peter knows this, and he's just calling him out for some behavior that he thinks Peter was being inconsistent with that principle, but it was a principle that Peter knew and agreed with.
Rex, I'm going to say thank you for that call. We are going to move on now to Don in Southlake, Texas. Lots of Texas callers today. Don, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hello, Jimmy.
Howdy.
Jimmy, hi, this is Don. How you doing today?
Just fine. What's your question, Don?
Well, I was reading the Catholic scripture reading yesterday, and it dawned on me something about Paul.
Mm-hmm.
The scriptures tell us that Paul was quite a zealot in persecuting the Christians before his encounter with Christ on the road to Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
And God would know that if it's almost like God would assume that Paul would never become a Christian without the miracle that occurred on the road to Damascus. And if for some reason or other something else occurred and that miracle never came to Paul, but God knew that he would do that, would then God give him an offer for salvation at the time of his death?
It's an interesting question. It gets us into an area where by nature we're speculating, because we're talking about a timeline that didn't unfold in our universe, and so it's hard to know exactly what would have happened. Now, various theologians have proposed that, and this is not a teaching of the church, but various theologians have proposed that God has something called middle knowledge. Middle knowledge is knowledge of what would have happened but didn't. And so it's possible, if God has middle knowledge, it's possible that he could have known that, wow, unless Paul's so hardcore, unless I appear to him directly, he's never going to turn around. And so he appeared to him, and that was how Paul got a shot. And if God had not chosen to appear to him, then Paul would have just continued on his course and never come to Jesus and never been saved. On the other hand, it's possible that God could have known if he has middle knowledge, or even if he didn't, it's possible that even if God never appeared to him, because Paul still has free will, he could have freely chosen to come to Jesus at some other point and been saved. So that's a possibility too, and we really don't know enough to know about what would have happened in alternate histories. One thing that should be true of all histories, though, is as the Second Vatican Council teaches, God makes it possible for everyone to be, quote-unquote, associated with the Paschal mystery, by which they mean saved. God has some mysterious way, even if we don't overtly perceive it in this life, of making it possible for every person to be saved, and that would include Paul. So whether that possibility was the one and only way that God appeared to him on the road to Damascus, or whether it could have been other ways, like enlightenment at the moment of death, that's something we have to leave into God's hands. But fundamentally, God wants us all to have the chance of salvation, and he makes that possible for all of us in one way or another.
Don, thank you very much for that call. That's what we call the good news, Jimmy.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more. Jimmy Akin, we're talking Paul and his companions on this Feast of Timothy and Titus. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed a list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Every question is important. Ask yours today on Catholic Answers Live.
Join Doug Keck and Father Joseph Mary Wolf live from San Francisco's largest pro-life event as the faithful take a stand for the unborn and all who suffer after decades of legalized abortion in the United States. Support life this January with EWTN. The Walk for Life West Coast, tomorrow afternoon, 2:30 Eastern on EWTN-TV and radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having lots of fun on this Friday with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. You can find lots of Jimmy's writing at jimmyakin.com.
.com.
.org go there too?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So we got them both. But go to jimmyakin.com and you'll find all kinds of cool stuff there. We're talking with Jimmy today about St. Paul and his companions. Lots of folks on the line. But I want to – if I'm going to monopolize you just for a minute.
Okay.
There.
Monopolize away.
All right. So
when that has Greek roots.
Mono.
Mm-hmm.
And
one.
Then poly. No, Paul.
Yeah, that one, I mean, there's several, I can see several cognates in Greek for that part. I'd have to look it up, but then Ezo for the eyes. part of it. Ezo is a common Greek ending for forms like that.
Well, I'm going to monopolize you right now. I sometimes have this feeling about Paul and his companions because most of them, it seems to me, please correct me if I'm wrong, never met Jesus in his earthly ministry and maybe didn't even meet the risen Lord, although Paul is certainly the exception there, that they would be like, oh, I just missed him. Like, I was just a few years late on this. Am I right about this? But Paul and his companions are mostly people who weren't there.
Mostly. There may be one or two exceptions. Like, I don't know about Silas. Silas might have, although I'd have to – I don't think we have evidence that he did.
Yeah.
Others may have. Mark was a temporary companion of Paul's early on, and then again later towards the end of his life. And Mark grew up in Jerusalem as a young man, and even though he probably would have been a child when Jesus' ministry was going on, he may have still seen it because he was one of the first Christian families in Jerusalem, and his mom owned a house where they would meet in Jerusalem. And we know that was happening within 10 years of Jesus's ministry. So it could well, they presumably were living there earlier. There are people, and this is a common theory actually, that Mark includes himself in his own gospel because there's this mysterious little bit where Jesus is being arrested and it says that there's a young man who they grab him and he wriggles out of his clothes and literally escapes, gets out of his cape and runs away. And a lot of people have said this is Mark putting himself in there as like, you know, how Alfred Hitchcock does a little cameo in all of his movies. Now, there's I'm personally a little skeptical of that. Mark is a young enough guy that I think he would have been too young at this time. And there's an interesting counter. This person could be any number of people, but there's a phenomenon that we see going on in the synoptic gospels, in the passion narratives, where certain people are anonymous, where you would expect them to be named, like the woman who anoints Jesus the person who cuts off the ear of the high priest. And it's like, wait, okay, so this person's clearly a follower of Jesus. They're clearly an important follower. Why aren't they named? Well, there's a prominent theory in some recent scholarship that the reason they're not named in the Synoptic Gospels is because they need protective anonymity, because they were committing acts that were prosecutable. Yeah. Like if you're the person who anoints Jesus, that's a revolutionary act.
Yes,
because they're expecting a political Messiah.
Right.
Yeah. Or if you attack and cut off the ear of the high priest's servant, that's, you know, the resisting arrest is only the start of the charges there.
Yeah.
So the thought is that the early Christian readers would have known who these people were, but the authors of the Gospels aren't putting their names in print until they're out of danger, which some of them were by the time the Gospel of John was written. And so in John, we find out that the woman who anointed Jesus was Mary Magdalene, and Mary of Bethany. And we also find out that the person who cut off the high priest's ear was Peter. And so presumably they weren't in danger anymore, possibly because they'd passed on or been martyred or something. But that leaves us with this mysteriously unnamed young man. And it's very plausible since he's clearly offering resistance to being arrested. I mean, they've grabbed him.
Yeah.
They don't seem to try to grab any of the other apostles, but they grab this guy and then he resists and he happens to get away. Well, could the early Christian audience have had any knowledge of who that was? And there's a very interesting suggestion that's been made by the British scholar Richard Baucom, which is that figure Because if you think about it, was there anyone else at this time that the Jewish authorities were trying to kill besides Jesus?
Oh, I know
and
who
in
it is.
John's gospel, there is somebody.
Yeah.
And it's
Lazarus.
Lazarus.
Yeah.
That's right. And because many people were starting to believe in Jesus, and John tells us the authorities wanted to kill Lazarus too.
Yeah.
So if Lazarus was there, it would make sense for the Jewish authorities to grab him too.
Yeah.
And he may have escaped. So that could be Lazarus, could be Mark, could be someone else. But my guess is that it's more likely either Lazarus or an unknown person than Mark, who would have been really very young at this point.
So these are people who were converts either – well, in Paul's case, it's very direct.
Mm-hmm.
But these are very enthusiastic, very on fire early converts who didn't see Jesus for the most part, Paul's companions.
Right. And that's even touched on by Jesus himself at the end of John's gospel, where he tells Thomas, you know, blessed are you because you saw and believed, but blessed are those who will not see and yet believe.
Uh-huh. But would these people have, like say Timothy and Titus, they were traveling around now with Paul, would they have run into the other apostles from time to time?
Oh, like, yeah.
Oh, I met Matthew, all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, I mean, when Peter was almost martyred by Herod Agrippa I in AD 43, this is in Acts chapter 12, where he goes is, after he's been miraculously released from jail by an angel, he goes to Mark's house.
Yeah.
And so Mark clearly would have known him.
Yeah.
There was interaction periodically between Peter and Paul, and so there were any companions of Paul would have interacted at the same time. We have good evidence that, like Luke, another traveling companion of Paul, was in Rome with Paul, and Peter by that point had become the bishop of Rome. And given the fact that the early chapters of Acts focus almost exclusively on Peter, it was probably through interviews with Peter where Luke got that information.
Yeah.
So so there was interaction between the different circles.
And would Peter maybe have seen Paul as kind of
annoying?
Not annoying. I don't.
The
Paul
answer
does
is
have to,
yes. Paul can be annoying.
Yeah, but no. As like someone God picked because he's so erudite. He's so well educated. Mm-hmm. He's not like me, Peter. I was picked to kind of experience Jesus and. But here's this Paul guy. He explains it to everybody.
Yeah, and in his epistles, Peter refers to Paul's wisdom in his writings and so forth.
Uh huh. All right. Let's go to Michael in Kingston, New York, listening on the EWTN app. Michael, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Thank you all for what you do. I have a friend who I spoke with about Jesus and the divinity of Jesus who is Jewish, and he tells me that he believes that Paul and his followers made up the story of him saying, I am, in front of the Sanhedrin, and the other sort of comments that, that we use to prove that Jesus was divine. He says that in the Old Testament, and even to this day, Talmudic and other scholars of Jewish law claim that there was no sense that the Messiah was going to be God himself. And I want to know how I can give him a rebuttal on this.
So it's always difficult when reading the Talmud to determine what prior Jewish tradition was at the time of Christ, because the Talmud is a collection of writings that were written centuries afterwards. Now, they try to preserve early Jewish traditions, but for the most part, it's later legal arguments about legal issues and interpretations of biblical laws and things like that. And it was written over a period of centuries that the chunk of the Talmud that's the biggest didn't even start being written until like 200 years after the time of Christ. So by that point, Christianity was established, and there would be a natural tendency on the part of non-Christian Jews to omit elements of prior tradition that Christians could have drawn on, because there had been a sharp divide in the identity of the two communities. And unless you have to, you don't want to acknowledge early information that your opponents could use to justify their position. And so it would have been natural for later rabbis to minimize or omit elements of early Jewish tradition in their later writings that could have supported Christianity. Having said that, if we look at some earlier writings, though, that are from before the time of the Talmud, like First Enoch, we find that there is a tradition where the Messiah is presented as a kind of celestial figure. It doesn't necessarily identify him with God himself, but it is one where the Son of Man is a celestial figure, and some scholars would even say a divine figure. And there is within the broader Jewish tradition, not simply what you find in the Talmud, but there is within the broader Jewish tradition certain strands that do point in the direction of a more supernatural type of Messiah than simply a human political leader. Having said that, it's not it is a fair point to say Jesus was an unexpected kind of Messiah. The vast majority of people in Jesus' day expected the Messiah or Messiahs, because there's also some traditions that speak of there being more than one, to be an earthly king. Who's just a normal human being like everybody else. He's got a part in God's plan, obviously, but he's just a human being. He's not a supernatural being, and he's going to be a political leader, not a savior from sins. And so Jesus was an unexpected type of Messiah, and the Gospels acknowledge that, because at various points Jesus does things, like in Mark, whenever he's in the territory of Israel, he tells people to keep word of his miracles kind of on the down low, because he doesn't want to get messianic expectations whipped up too high so that people will try to cart him off and make him their king. This comes up in the Gospel of John 2. Having said that, it's not simply Paul who views Jesus as divine. That's a theme that's found in multiple books of the New Testament. It's something that was common in Christianity in general. And if you want to read about that, I would suggest the works of a scholar named Larry Hurtado, Hurtado. If you go on Amazon and look up his books, I think some of them may even be on sale in Kindle format right now. But Larry Hurtado has written a number of books about Jesus at the origins of Christian worship and things like that, and has shown that in a variety of different texts, in a variety of different ways, the early Christians did worship Jesus and recognize that in the divine-human divide, that he falls on the divine side, that he's not simply a human being, that he's more than that. And so, once again, that scholar's name is Larry Hurtado, Hurtado.
Michael, I have to leave it there and say thank you for that call, because we have to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're talking about St. Paul and his co-workers in the vineyard. We'll be right back with more of that and your calls after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here with a couple of very special offers for all of you interested in standing up for the rights of the unborn. January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and my DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a saving of over 70%. I wrote this book and I made this DVD specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or my DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is.
Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. And at $3 a copy when purchased in bulk, it's perfect for parish distribution and any of your adult faith formation needs. And in an effort to get copies into as many hands as possible, this weekend we're offering free media mail shipping within the continental United States. There's simply no better time to place your order. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And we're talking today about Paul and his companions, because the church celebrates two of his most significant companions and co-workers in the vineyard, Timothy and Titus, today. Lots of people, I actually thought we were going to just chat a lot, Jimmy, but mm-hmm. lots of people have questions for you about awesome. Timothy, Titus, Paul, all of them. Let's go to Dion in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Dion, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Good evening. How's everyone doing?
Very well, Dion.
Just have a question. Reading Timothy, both 1st and 2nd, and reading Titus, in my reading, it seems that Timothy was not as mature as Titus, because Paul writes a little more strict and a little more maturely to Titus and preach the things that become sound doctrine, go down there, make ordained elders in every city that I have ordained you in Crete, and he speaks about the order of the church, the protocol of the elders and the bishops. But with Timothy, he says, Timothy, don't let no one intimidate your youth. You got to be an example to the flock, first you up to your grandmother and then your mother. And he's encouraging Timothy, I laid hands on you, the presbyter laid hands on you. And he seems he's trying to encourage Timothy to step up and be the man of God that we have licensed you, ordained you to be in the church. Am I reading that correctly, or am I missing something?
Well, it's certainly something that some scholars have speculated, that Timothy may have been a little more shy and retiring than Titus, and so Paul's kind of bucking him up here by telling him to, you know, fulfill his ministry as an evangelist and so forth. I think it's fair to say that. I don't know that it's the only interpretation. One thing I think is plausible is that Timothy was younger, because Paul does make the remark about don't let anybody despise your youth to Timothy, but he doesn't say anything like that to Titus. And also, Titus, as we mentioned earlier in the show, had already been Paul's companion before Timothy was. And so that would also suggest that Titus was older. He may have been the same age as Paul, or even older for all we know. But Timothy's clearly younger than Paul and clearly a young man. My question would not so much be, does this automatically mean that Timothy is less mature or shyer, but just that he's going to encounter some ageism with regard, some prejudice against the fact that he's a youth? And I don't think that that Paul's statement about don't let anybody despise your youth is necessarily meant for Timothy, because one of the things you find when you read these letters is, even though they're addressed to Timothy and Titus, to single individuals, it also appears – they also contain statements that seem like they're directed to the churches in which Timothy and Titus were ministering. And so and this is what you would expect, because in the ancient world, they had basically zero privacy. I mean, everybody was around everybody all the time, and you just didn't have your own private room where you went and slept and stuff. And so when a scribe came and had a letter to read, he would read it out loud and everybody would hear it. And so there's a social context to the reading of letters, even when they're directed to individuals. And so when Paul is telling Timothy, don't let anybody despise your youth, I don't think that's necessarily an indicator that Timothy is insecure about his youth. That's Paul's polite way of telling all the people in Ephesus, don't despise Timothy's youth. He's priming the crowd to give Timothy the respect he deserves. And so I don't know that it indicates a lack of maturity on Timothy's part. He is younger, but he's of the two in terms of evangelistic efforts. I mean, he's the one that gets mentioned like twice as often in the New Testament as Titus and had the bigger legacy in church history. So if anything, he may have been the more active one, and that would tend to speak to significant confidence on his part. And so I think some of these comments may be more directed to the surrounding social audience that's hearing the letter read rather than Timothy himself.
Dion, thanks very much for that call. You really don't usually think about that, about the lack of privacy in the ancient world. Is it connected with it's a poorer society than ours?
They lived in tiny houses and dwellings and stuff, and you had lots of people crammed into them. And it's also just a cultural difference. I was once reading it was actually in a book about Paul's letters, but to illustrate this point, the author, I think it was Richardson, was talking about some of the things that missionaries would encounter, like in Indonesia. In Indonesia, they have a different sense of personal space than we do,
and they
don't have the same privacy ethic. And so there was this missionary family from the Western world who were used to having privacy, but then they were living in Indonesia, and the family that they were, you know, they had servants and so forth. They were employing servants in their household, and whenever like the wife in the family would like go into the bedroom to like do personal correspondence or something and be alone, the servants would naturally come with her so she wouldn't have to be alone.
Trying
to be with him so she won't be lonely.
But
that was not her experience culturally.
Right. Let's go to Gil in Manhattan, New York. Gil, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, guys. I want to ask a question. What is the relationship between Paul's love and Titus and Timothy love for the widows and similar about that?
Well, so obviously widows were economically vulnerable in the ancient world without a husband as a breadwinner, and with oftentimes, you know, they could be elderly too by the time their husband died, by the time they became widows. And so they had challenges of age, and they had less income in their households, and they were perceived as vulnerable, and there weren't a lot of jobs open to women at the time, so they had limited ability to bring in money themselves. They were vulnerable, and so the church, from its earliest days, in fact, from even before Paul's conversion, was making provisions to help out widows, and we see that in the book of Acts. If you look in Acts chapter 6 and 7 and so forth and on into Stephen's martyrdom, that's how the seven originally got appointed. It was in order to ensure a fair distribution of resources to Greek-speaking Jewish widows compared to Aramaic-speaking Jewish widows. So this was a longtime concern in the church. It certainly would have been shared by Paul and Timothy and Titus. And in the pastoral letters in 1 Timothy, Paul actually gives something of an extended discussion of how Timothy should regulate the affairs of the church in Ephesus with regard to widows. He says that younger widows should remarry because they're going to want to remarry at some point, even if they think right now, oh, I want to devote myself wholly to Christ, that in practice there's going to come a point where they want to remarry. And if they've taken a pledge of consecrated widowhood to Christ, then they're going to be tempted to violate that pledge. So he says only let older widows be enrolled in this order. And given the fact there seems to have been a vow of widowhood they were taking, this is basically an early religious order. It's like an early order of nuns. And so he says only enroll the older ones and make sure that they have a reputation for hospitality and good works and washing the feet of the saints and things like that. So they're known to be good and holy people rather than wanton spongers, in essence. And so So there was concern there, but I don't know of any way to differentiate how Paul felt about these widows from how Timothy and Titus did. I assume they were pretty much all on the same page.
Okay, Gil?
Thank you. I can't wait to be in heaven with Paul and Titus and Timothy and the Blessed Mother Mary.
Me too.
It's going to be exciting.
Yep.
Praise God.
And Jesus too, Gil. Thanks very much. Thanks for that call. Jimmy?
Yeah.
I wonder if, well, never mind what I wonder about, because there's the music.
Yeah, well.
But thanks for another great hour.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun.
You seem to really, I mean, you call Paul annoying. He can be annoying, but
yeah.
You seem to have a real affinity for
Paul.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Because what?
Because he's an inspired apostle that wrote much of the book that I hold most dear in life.
That's all?
Well,
okay.
Is that enough?
Jimmy, yeah, thank you very, very much. Thanks, everybody who has joined us this week. Thanks, Nick, for doing the sound. Thanks, Kathleen, for doing the video. All right, Nathan, thank you for doing the phones. We will see you on Monday, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.